Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk of London's most notorious and often forgotten murder cases, all set within 1 square mile of the West End. Today's episode is a guided walk of the little-known death of Jane Farvish. A humble Soho resident with a simple problem to solve. And yet her agonising, lingering and painful death is not the most shocking element of this case. And although this isn't a murder as such, the actions of the man who killed her and the outcome of the story is certain to make your blood boil. Murder Mile contains vivid descriptions, which may not be suitable for those of a sensitive disposition, as well as photos, videos and maps which accompany this series, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 6, The Deadliest Dentist in Soho. Today, I'm standing on Broadwick Street, W1. A heavily renovated part of Soho that is unrecognisable from the grotty, crumbling, tumble-down slum that it once was. A place where no one would choose to live unless their life took an unfortunate turn for the worse. And yet, hints of its former self still exist, as much of this partly pedestrianised street is covered in cobbles, speckled with Grade 2 listed buildings, and dotted with the occasional Victorian streetlight or bollard, but the rest is all new, bright and shiny. Looking supremely clean, neatly sculpted and painfully cosmopolitan, although barely the length of a football field, Broadwick Street today consists of two one-way streets which converge in the middle and confuse the hell out of every motorist who has stupidly turned off Wardour Street to the east, and is either stuck in a rabbit's warren of impossibly tight side streets, or has come a cropper at Carnaby Street to the west, which only a local would know is a dead end. Being a very modern part of the metropolis, the pace of life on Broadwick Street is slow. Here you can sup a posh coffee in the Nespresso Café, sample a feta and red pepper pitta in London's first vegetarian pret-a-manger, hobnob with the celebs at the exclusive Ivy restaurant, slink off for a snooze in a teeny tiny boutique apartment, as well as queuing up for an hour to be suspiciously glared at by a steroid-fueled security guard in a super snotty shoe shop, which has literally 10 pairs of shoes for sale. Here, everything is calm, sedate and serene. Which, strangely, is exactly how Jane Farvish was, after her swollen and bloody face had stopped twitching. On the corner of Broadwick Street, situated at numbers 15 to 17, sits a 5-star rated contemporary Chinese restaurant called Yaoicha, which specialises in dim sum, cocktails and handmade sweets. but its brightly coloured, pristine clean and supremely stylish glass-fronted facade is a far cry from the hideous hovel it once was. And so difficult was this location to find. It's almost as if someone has deliberately and repeatedly attempted to erase it from history. In the early 1900s, on this site stood a three-story dilapidated townhouse from the early 1700s. It was in such a sorry state of disrepair that the house and most of this street was entirely demolished, rebuilt, renamed, and renumbered in the 1930s, and then decimated by two Nazi bombs in the 1940s, and rebuilt again in the 2000s, with the latest phase of rebuilding continuing right up until today. But by 1908, in the final year of Jane Farvish's life, this building was numbered 54A Broad Street. Broad Street was a festering pocket of urban decay, where much of the city's poorest were crammed into the crumbling remains of the slum housing. Daylight was obscured by the belching fumes from the Lion Brewery. The stench of open cesspits, full of human feces, stung their nostrils. An infected water pump, which, just 50 years earlier, had caused a cholera outbreak so severe that one-sixth of Soho's population had died. And under their feet stood a plague pit, 500 feet wide, 600 feet long, and packed with rotting corpses, 10 bodies deep, all of whom had died of the dreaded Black Death. It's safe to say that, unless they really had to, Broad Street was a place where no one wanted to work and no one wanted to live. And although he wasn't a resident of Soho, having wisely decided to live in the more affluent Shepherd's Bush, roughly 4.5 miles to the west, by 1908, the ground floor of 54A Broad Street was a simple two-room premises, which went by the name of Soho Drugstores. A chemist's and a dentist's shop with a wooden sign on the door which simply read, "Teeth Extracted." It was owned by Isidore Ziefert. Born in Moscow in 1875, Isidore Ziefert was a 5'4" Russian Jew of slender build, who, although he came from a relatively privileged background and was blessed with a higher-than-average intelligence and a burning desire to succeed, he would always struggle to achieve his goals that he felt he deserved, owing to an air of arrogance which surrounded him. Having supposedly studied medicine in Vilnia, which is now Vilnius in the former Russian Republic of Lithuania, for 7 years, all prior to his 22nd birthday, Ziefert was forced to flee during the pogrom in the late 1800s, when thousands of Russian Jews were persecuted, hunted, and murdered for their religious and political beliefs. With very few provable qualifications, Ziefert enrolled 300 miles away at the Red Cross Hospital in Warsaw, in the former Russian Republic of Poland, where he undertook what he would describe as a special course of medicine and surgery, prior to studying for a bachelor's degree in medicine. Sadly, having spent 5 years at Warsaw University, prior to his final examination, Ziefert was arrested on an unspecified charge for what he would later refer as political reasons. And yet again, Ziefert was forced to flee, this time leaving his home country behind forever. By 1902, 27-year-old Isidore Ziefert had arrived in London, over 1,000 miles from the border of his native Russia, with very few belongings, very little money, and almost no medical credentials. So being unqualified, partially trained, and woefully inexperienced, the best employment that Ziefert could get was by assisting a variety of medical practitioners in a strictly junior capacity, including Dr. Glicksman for just over 1 year, Dr. Harvey for almost 3 years, and another unspecified doctor for 2 years, where he helped administer a variety of powerful anesthetics to their patients. Before setting up his own chemist's and dentist shop at 54A Broad Street. And yet, during his trial, when questioned about his woeful lack of qualifications and experience, Isidore Ziefert, the 33-year-old, slightly cocky, but equally nervous prisoner, who had no medical degree, no chemist license, and who was not and would never be registered as a practicing oral surgeon, would later state in court,
"For about 13 years, I have been in constant practice as a dentist."
Today, dentists are heavily regulated, routinely tested, and highly qualified. But up until 1879, Britain had no compulsory registration nor qualification for dentists, meaning anyone, whether a doctor, a teacher, a butcher, or even a barber, could set up shop as a dentist. Thankfully, with the British Parliament passing the First Dentist Act in 1878 and establishing a dental register in 1879, it was decreed that only qualified professionals who could prove that they had practiced dentistry for the past 5 years were eligible to register. But somehow, Isidore Ziefert slipped through the net. By 1908, Soho drugstores at 54A Broad Street had been open for less than a year, and yet business was busy, as the poor condition of the average person's teeth had begun to take its toll. Most households had just one toothbrush per family, made from soft feathered twigs, which they all shared, but many families had none. And so, as the average person's diet got sweeter, combined with a severe lack of fresh fruit to eat and clean water to drink, many of the poorest people, by their early 20s, didn't have a set of teeth, so much as they had a misshapen collection of swollen, painful stumps, brown jutting shards, and infected rotten holes. Although Broad Street was a filthy, rancid slum, by situating himself in the dead centre of Soho, Isidore Ziefert had truly found a niche for himself. As with many Russian Jews who'd escaped the horrors of the pogroms, having settled in this area, and being rightfully fearful of outsiders, Ziefert was one of the few Russian Jewish dentists in this tightly knit community. And although he was inexperienced and unqualified, he was cheap, trusted, local, and best of all, he was one of their own. For 3 painful days and 3 sleepless nights, 41-year-old Jane Farvish of Church Street, Soho, a woman who would be unflatteringly described as being of generous proportions, had been suffering with chronic toothache, which had left her tired and weak. So much so that her constant moaning, groaning, and writhing in agony had meant that her husband Nathan and their daughter Annie were unable to sleep in the tiny one-roomed lodging that they shared. Like most people, Jane Farvish had never visited a dentist in her life, and nor did she plan to do so, as although her toothy yellowy stumps and red swollen gums were excruciatingly painful, a trip to the dentist was a notoriously unpleasant experience, especially if you were poor. As not only were many dentists unskilled, untrained, and often unqualified, the instruments they had to work with were crude metal tools like the infamous extractor, a barbaric primitive stick with a sharp metal claw at the end, which, like a set of pliers, would wrench, twist, and pull the rotten tooth out of its swollen hole as blood poured down the patient's face. Of course, you could always pay for an anesthetic to dull the pain, such as gas, chloroform, and nitrous oxide, but only if you could afford to. Whereas if you were poor, you had to be held down, and hope that you passed out before the pain got too bad. Luckily for Jane Farvish, Nathan, her husband, had asked around, and her closest friends in this tight-knit Jewish community had recommended a local dentist, situated just a few streets away, and had reassured her that
Isidor Ziefert, he is a good man, a good dentist. He is one of us, you can trust him.
And with that, Nathan, Annie, and Jane made that fateful 6-minute walk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
The icy wind blasted their frozen faces as they trudged through the knee-deep snow along Old Compton Street and turned right into Wardour Street. But it wasn't the blistering wind which slowed Jane's pace to a crawl. As being too tired to eat and too weak to sleep, owing to her chronic toothache, Jane was also riddled with rheumatism, racked with headaches, as her lungs wheezed, her heart palpitated, and her exhausted organs struggled to cope under the enormous pressure of her plump, round body. Meaning three times on that short journey, they had to stop so Jane could rest. On Saturday the 18th of January 1908, at 3:20 p.m, all three members of the Farvish family entered Soho Drugstores at 54A Broad Street, which consisted of two wood-lined rooms, a chemist shop up front, featuring a rear wall full of small wooden drawers, and a long wide counter completed with a till, pills, a pestle and mortar, and vials of potions, lotions and poisons. And behind the shop was the dentist's surgery, which was staffed by Isidor Ziefert. Being barely able to speak through her tiredness and pain, Jane Farvish let her daughter Annie do most of the talking.
"My mother is weak. She is suffering from rheumatism. She has been up all night suffering from the toothache," she said,
as her weak, wheezing mother was led into the surgery and slowly sat in his hideously cheap dentist chair, which was made from an odd mix of wood and wicker. As Jane lay back, her weight supported by the chair, her aching limbs no longer struggling and her frozen toes slowly soothed by the roaring log fire, Ziefert opened his patient's mouth and instantly he was hit by the smell of rotten meat from the two impacted yellow stumps, which once upon a time had been a tooth.
"I'll need to remove those two stumps," Ziefert huffed,
something clearly on his mind as his eyes switched from his patient to his clock, although even today no one quite knows why. As she lay there, the pain causing her head to pound, her face to throb, and her heart to erratically pump, seeing his wife's agony grow and her body weaken, her husband Nathan requested that she be given an anesthetic so those two infected stumps could be removed without pain, and asked the dentist for gas, a cheap and common painkiller which, although effective, often caused temporary oxygen starvation of the brain, which, although not fatal, if done correctly, would result in the patient suffering from sickness and headaches for weeks. But then again, Zeford was out of gas. And so, although very poor, but not wanting Jane to suffer any more, Nathan, her loyal and devoted husband, stumped up half a crown for the best anesthetic that his modest income could afford. That painkiller of choice was cocaine. Before it became a favourite recreational drug for the middle classes in the 1980s, cocaine had been in medical use in England since 1884, and although it was still in use in 1908, by then it was listed under the 1905 UK Poisons Act, which meant it could only be prescribed by a licensed chemist. And although it worked fantastically fast as a painkiller, which left you with a wonderful feeling of euphoria, cocaine has a few small side effects, such as sweating, fever, high blood pressure, and an erratic heart rate, which for an average healthy person wouldn't be too problematic, but for a person of generous proportions, like Jane Farvish, who was already at an increased risk of stroke, lung disease, and heart attacks, cocaine could be deadly. Sadly, Soho drugstores no longer had a licensed chemist, let alone a qualified dentist, as just 2 months earlier, Dr. Sellers had left following a heated argument with Isidore Zeford over unpaid wages and a matter of medical ethics. And so, with his patient in pain, her face sweating, her chest wheezing, and her heart pounding, Zeford popped into the shop to prepare the painkiller. From one of the small wooden drawers, Zeford pulled out a small glass syringe, a pipette of water, and a small brown bottle marked with the words poison, which legally cocaine was, and prepared a solution of 10 drops of water and half a grain, roughly 90 milligrams, of cocaine. With her husband holding her head back, the syringe's needle poked into her red swollen gums, causing her to wince. But within seconds, the pain had gone. A sense of calm descended over the dentist's surgery, as for the first time in 3 days, a small smile crept over Jane's face, as she slowly relaxed and her moaning ceased. But moments later, she began to sweat, her pulse was heavy, and her breathing was erratic. Naturally, Nathan was concerned, as was Annie, but Zeford reassured them that this was simply a side effect of the cocaine, and began preparing his tools to extract her rotten tooth. The last words that Jane would ever utter, as she stared into a mirror at her strangely distorted face, was,
"Look what he makes my face like. It is all crooked," she said,
her speech barely audible and slurred. Yet again, Zeford reassured them both how perfectly normal this was, and replied,
"When the tooth is out, it will be all right again,"
and proceeded to painlessly wrench, twist, and pull the first of the rotten yellowy stumps free with the metal claw of his trusty extractor. But as Zeford started to twist the second stump free, Jane's mouth began to billow with a mix of red blood and white froth. Suddenly, her muscles tensed, her back arched, her eyes rolled, and her whole body began to violently convulse. It shook so fiercely, she almost snapped the leg of the wooden chair she was sitting in. Until eventually, drenched in sweat and physically exhausted, She passed out. With no faith in his ability, Annie dashed into the street to find a doctor, as Jane was laid on the couch. Her swollen face contorted, and her lips bubbling with a reddening froth as a constant trickle of blood poured from the open wound in her gums onto the cold stone floor. Under her nose, Isidore Ziefert pointlessly waved a small bottle of smelling salts, his nervous hands shaking, his voice quivering. And yet again, he protested his innocence and reassured Nathan how normal this all was, and said,
"Don't be afraid. Your wife will be like this for about 10 minutes. No more.
But after 3/4 of an hour, Jane was silent, she was still, and she was cold to the touch. 41-year-old Jane Farvish was officially pronounced dead at 6:40 p.m. At 8 p.m, Isidore Ziefert was taken to the Marlborough Street police station and charged with unlawful manslaughter, to which he replied,
"I only administered half a grain. It was in 10 drops of water. I have done it hundreds of times. No harm has ever resulted. Till now."
Dr. Ludwig Freiberger conducted a post-mortem on the deceased and stated that her heart was small, fatty, pliable between the fingers, and the mitral valve was thickened, and that the cause of death was failure of the heart and respiration. Given her size and age, a cursory examination of the heart would easily have indicated that she had a diseased mitral valve, as when it is listened to using a stethoscope, the valve makes a very distinctive sound. And with a fifth or a sixth of a grain of cocaine being a more than sufficient dose as an anaesthetic, not half a grain, as Ziefert had administered, the pathologist concluded that, "In my opinion, her death was caused by cocaine poisoning." Following his pre-trial at Westminster Coroner's Court, he was tried at the Old Bailey on the 3rd of March 1908. And even though Isidore Ziefert pleaded not guilty, he called no witnesses to his defence. And after a short deliberation, the jury concluded that not only had Isidore Ziefert injected his patient with more than double the safe dosage of cocaine, but also, having only checked the gums of this 41-year-old woman of generous proportions, who'd arrived into his shop too weak to stand, too tired to stay awake, and too breathless to walk unaided, he had failed to check the state of her heart, which was standard practice when administering such a dangerous poison. When the jury returned their verdict to the unlawful murder of Jane Farvish, Isidore Ziefert, the untrained, unqualified, and woefully inexperienced dentist and chemist, was found not guilty. And even though the jury confirmed that he was guilty of reckless and criminal negligence, Ziefert was discharged without hesitation and allowed to walk free. The judge recommended that in future, when administering cocaine, that he be more careful. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. This series is available on almost all podcast platforms, so please do check us out and don't forget to click subscribe so the very latest episodes will be downloaded to your device as you sleep. How amazing is that? If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate us and like and share us with your friends. And if you fancy some exercise, why not treat yourself to Murder Mile Walk? It's my guided walk of Soho's most infamous murder cases, featuring 12 murderers across 15 locations, totaling almost 50 mysterious deaths in just 1 mile. Tickets are available via my website, murdermiletours.com. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the music written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Next week's episode is the Identikit murder at the old curiosity shop. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.